scorn, as if she heard nothing. Tom had always lived among refined and cultivated people, and he felt intuitively, from her air and bearing, that she belonged to that class. But how or why she could be fallen to those degrading circumstances he could not tell. The women neither looked at him nor spoke to him, though all the way to the field she kept close at his side. Tom was soon busy at his work, but as the woman was at no great distance from him, he often glanced an eye to her, at her work. He saw at a glance that a native adroitness and handiness made the task to her an easier one than it proved to many. She picked very fast and very clean, and with an air of scorn, as if she despised both the work and the disgrace and humiliation of the circumstances in which she was placed. In the course of the day Tom was working near the mulatto woman who had been bought in the same lot with himself. She was evidently in a condition of great suffering, and Tom often heard her praying, as she wavered and trembled and seemed about to fall down. Tom silently, as he came near to her, transferred several handfuls of cotton from his own sack to hers.
"Oh, don't," said the woman, looking surprised. "It'll get you into trouble."
Just then Sambo came up. He seemed to have a special spite against this woman, and flourishing his whip, said in brutal, guttural tones, "What is here, Lucy? Foolin' her?" And with a word, kicking the woman with his heavy cowhide shoe, he struck Tom across the face with his whip. Tom silently resumed his task, but the woman, before, at the last point of exhaustion, fainted.
"I'll bring her to," said the driver with a brutal grin. "I'll give her something better than camphor."
And taking a pin from his coat sleeve, he buried it to the head in her flesh. The woman groaned and half rose.
"Get up, you beast, and work, will you, or I'll show you a trick more."
The woman seemed stimulated for a few moments to an unnatural strength, and worked with desperate eagerness.
"See that you keep to that hour," said the man, "or your wish is dead tonight, I reckon."
"That I do now," Tom heard her say, and again he heard her say, "Oh, Lord, how long? Oh, Lord, why don't you help us?" At the risk of all that he might suffer, Tom came forward again and put all the cotton in his sack into the woman's.
"Oh, you mustn't. You don't know what they'll do to you," said the woman. "I can bear it," said Tom, "better than you."
And he was at his place again. It passed in a moment. Suddenly, the stranger woman, whom we have described, and who had, in the course of her work, come near enough to hear Tom's last words, raised her heavy black eyes and fixed them for a second on him. Then, taking a quantity of cotton from her basket, she placed it in his.
"You know nothing about this place," she said, "or you wouldn't have done that. When you've been here a month, you'll be done helping anybody. You'll find it hard enough to take care of your own skin."
"The Lord forbid, missus," said Tom, using instinctively to his field companion the respectful form proper to the high-bred with whom he had lived.
"The Lord never visits these parts," said the woman bitterly, as she went nimbly forward with her work, and again the scornful smile curled her lips.
But the action of the woman had been seen by the driver across the field, and flourishing his whip he came up to her.
"What? What?" he said to the woman, with an air of triumph. "You a foolin'? Go along! You're under me now, mind yourself, or you'll catch it!"
A glance like sheet lightning suddenly flashed from those black eyes, and fancying about with quivering lip and dilated nostrils, she drew herself up and fixed a glance, blazing with rage and scorn on the driver.
"Dog," she said, "touch me if you dare. I've power enough yet to have you torn by the dogs, burnt alive, cut to inches. I've only to say the word."
"What the devil you here for, then?" said the man, evidently cowed and sullenly retreating a step or two. "Didn't mean no harm, Miss Cassie."
"Keep your distance, then," said the woman.
And in truth, the man seemed greatly inclined to attend to something at the other end of the field, and started off in quick time. The woman suddenly turned to her work and labored with a dispatch that was perfectly astonishing to Tom. She seemed to work by magic. Before the day was through, her basket was filled, crowded down, and piled, and she had several times put largely into Tom's. Long after dusk, the whole weary train, with their baskets on their heads, defiled up to the building appropriated to the storing and weighing of the cotton. Legree was there, busily conversing with the two drivers.
"Dad, our Tom's going to make a powerful deal of trouble, keep a-putting into Lucy's basket. One of these, year that, will get all these niggers to feeling busy, if Massa don't watch 'em," said Sambo. "Heyday, the black cuss," said Legree. "He'll have to get a breakin' in, won't he, boys?"
Both negroes grinned a horrid grin at this intimation.
"Aye, aye, let Massa Legree alone for breakin' in. The devil himself couldn't beat Massa at that," said Quimbo. "Well, boys, the best way is to give him flogging to do, till he gets over his notions. Break him in." "Lord, Massa, have hard work to get that out of him."
"It'll have to come out of him, though," said Legree, as he rolled his tobacco in his mouth.
Now there's Lucy, the aggravationist, ugliest wench on the place, pursued Sambo. Take care, Sam, I shall begin to think what's the reason for your spite against Lucy. Well, Massa knows she sought herself up against Massa, and wouldn't have me when he told her to. I'd have flogged her into it, said Legree, spitting, only there's such a press of work it don't seem worth a while to upset her just now. She's slender, but these year slender gals will bear half-killing to get their own way. Well, Lucy was real aggravating and lazy, sulking round, wouldn't do nothing, and Tommy stuck up for her. He did, eh? Well, then, Tom shall have the pleasure of flogging her. It'll be a good practice for him, and he won't put it on to the gal like he devils, neither. Ha, ha, laughed both the sooty wretches, and the diabolical sound seemed, in truth, a not unapt expression of the fiendish character which Legree gave them. Well, but Master Tom and Missy Casey and Day among them filled Lucy's basket. A rather guest or waits, innit, Massa? I do the weighing, said Legree emphatically. Both the drivers again laughed their diabolical laugh. So, he added, Miss Casey did a day's work. She picks like the devil and all his angels. She's got 'em all in her, I believe, said Legree, and growling a brutal oath, he proceeded to the weighing room. Slowly the weary, dispirited creatures wound their way into the room, and with crouching reluctance presented their baskets to be weighed. Legree noted on a slate on the side of which was pasted a list of names the amount. Tom's basket was weighed and approved, and he looked with an anxious glance for the success of the woman he had befriended. Tottering with weakness, she came forward and delivered her basket. It was of full weight, as Legree well perceived, but affecting anger. He said, "What, you lazy beast? Show it again. Stand aside. You'll catch it pretty soon." The woman gave a groan of utter despair and sat down on a board. The person who had been called Miss Cassie now came forward, and with a haughty, negligent air delivered her basket. As she delivered it, Legree looked in her eyes with a sneering yet inquiring glance. She fixed her black eyes steadily on him, her lips moved slightly, and she said something in French. What it was, no one knew, but Legree's face became perfectly demoniacal in its expression as she spoke. He half raised his hand as if to strike, a gesture which she regarded with fierce disdain as she turned and walked away. "And now," said Legree, "come here, you Tom. You see, I told you I didn't buy you just for the common work. I mean to promote you and make a driver of you, and tonight you may just as well begin to get your hand in. Now you just take this here gal and flog her. You've seen enough on to know how." "I beg Massa's pardon," said Tom. "Hopes Massa won't set me at that. It's what I ain't used to, never did, and can't do, no way possible." "You'll learn a pretty smart chance of things you never did know before I've done with you," said Legree, taking up a cowhide and striking Tom a heavy blow across the cheek, and following up with the infliction by a shower of blows. "There," he said as he stopped to rest. "Now will you tell me you can't do it?" "Yes, Massa," said Tom, putting up his hand to wipe the blood that trickled down his face. "I'm willing to work day and night and work while there's life and breath in me. But this here thing, I can't feel it right to do. And Massa, I never shall do it. Never." Tom had a remarkably smooth, soft voice and a habitually respectful manner that had given Legree an idea that he would be cowardly and easily subdued. When he spoke these last words, a thrill of amazement went through everyone. The poor woman clasped her hands and said, "Oh, Lord!" And everyone involuntarily looked at each other and drew in their breath as if to prepare for the storm that was about to burst. Legree looked stupefied and confounded, but at last burst forth. "What, you blasted black beast! Tell me, you don't think it right to do what? I tell you! What have any of you cuss cattle to do with thinking what's right? I'll put a stop to it. Well, what do you think you are? Maybe you think you're a gentleman, Master Tom, to be a-telling your master what's right and what ain't, so you pretend it's wrong to flog the gal?"
"I think so, Master," said Tom. "The poor critter's sick, feeble. 'Twould be downright cruel. And it's what I never will do, nor begin to. Master, if you mean to kill me, kill me. But as to my raising my hand against anyone here, I never shall. I'll die first."
Tom spoke in a mild voice, but with a decision that could not be mistaken. Legree shook with anger, his greenish eyes glared fiercely, and his very whiskers seemed to curl with passion. But like some ferocious beast that plays with its victim before he devours it, he kept back his strong impulse to proceed to immediate violence, and broke out into bitter raillery.
Well, here's a pious dog at last, let down among us sinners. A saint, a gentleman, and no less to talk to us sinners about our sins. Powerful holy critter he must be. Here, you rascal, you make believe to be so pious. Didn't you never hear, your Bible? Servants obey your masters. Ain't I your master? Didn't I pay down $1,200, cash for all there is inside your old cussed black shell? Ain't you mine, now body and soul, he said, giving Tom a violent kick with his heavy boot. Tell me. In the very depth of physical suffering, bowed by brutal oppression, this question shot a gleam of joy and triumph through Tom's soul. He suddenly stretched himself up, and looking earnestly to heaven, while the tears and blood that flowed down his face mingled, he exclaimed, "No, no, no. My soul ain't yours, massa. You haven't bought it. You can't buy it. It's been bought and paid for by one that is able to keep it. No matter, no matter. You can't harm me."
"I can't," said Legree with a sneer.
"We'll see. We'll see. Yeah, Sambo. Quimbo. Give this dog such a breaking in as he won't get over this month."
The two gigantic negroes that now laid hold of Tom with fiendish exultation in their faces might have formed no unapt personification of powers of darkness. The poor woman screamed with apprehension and all rose as by a general impulse, while they dragged him unresisting from the place.
Chapter 34. The Quadroon's Story. And behold, the tears of such as are oppressed, and on the side of their oppressors there was power. Wherefore I praise the dead that are already dead, more than the living that are yet alive. Ecclesiastes 4:1. It was late at night, and Tom lay groaning and bleeding alone, in an old forsaken room of the gin house, among pieces of broken machinery, piles of damaged cotton, and other rubbish which had there accumulated. The night was damp and close, and the thick air swarmed with myriads of mosquitoes, which increased the restless torture of his wounds. Whilst a burning thirst, a torture beyond all others, filled up the uttermost measure of physical anguish. "O good Lord, do look down. Give me the victory. Give me the victory over all," prayed poor Tom, in his anguish. A footstep entered the room, behind him, and the light of a lantern flashed on his eyes.
"Who's there? Oh, for the Lord's mercy, please give me some water."
The woman Cassie, for it was she, set down her lantern, and pouring water from a bottle, raised his head and gave him drink. Another and another cup were drained with feverish eagerness.
"Drink all you want," she said. "I knew how it would be."
"It isn't the first time I've been out in the night carrying water to such as you."
"Thank you, missus," said Tom, when he had done drinking. "Don't call me missus. I'm a miserable slave like yourself. A lower one than you can ever be," said she bitterly. "But now," said she, going to the door and dragging in a small palaise, over which she had spread linen cloths wet with cold water, "try, my poor fellow, to roll yourself onto this." Stiff with wounds and bruises, Tom was a long time in accomplishing this movement, but when done he felt a sensible relief from the cooling application to his wounds.
The woman, whom long practice with the victims of brutality had made familiar with many healing arts, went on to make many applications to Tom's wounds, by means of which he was soon somewhat relieved.
"Now," said the woman, when she had raised his head on a roll of damaged cotton, which served for a pillow, "there's the best I can do for you."
Tom thanked her, and the woman, sitting down on the floor, drew up her knees and, embracing them with her arms, looked fixedly before her, with a bitter and painful expression of countenance. Her bonnet fell back, and long, wavy streams of black hair fell around her singular and melancholy face.
"It's no use, my poor fellow," she broke out at last. "It's of no use, this you've been trying to do.
You were a brave fellow. You had the right on your side, but it's all in vain and out of the question for you to struggle. You are in the devil's hands. He is the strongest, and you must give up."
"Give up?
Had not human weakness and physical agony whispered that before? Tom started, for the bitter woman, with her wild eyes and melancholy voice, seemed to him an embodiment of the temptation with which he had been wrestling. "O Lord, O Lord," he groaned, "how can I give up?" "There's no use calling on the Lord. He never hears," said the woman, steadily. "There isn't any God, I believe, or if there is, he's taken sides against us. All goes against us, heaven and earth. Everything is pushing us into hell. Why shouldn't we go?" Tom closed his eyes and shuddered at the dark, atheistic words. "You see," said the woman, "you don't know anything about it. I do. I've been on this place 5 years, body and soul under this man's foot, and I hate him as I do the devil. Here you are, on a lone plantation, 10 miles from any other, in the swamps. Not a white person here who could testify if you were burned alive, if you were scalded, cut into inch pieces, set up for the dogs to tear, or hung up and whipped to death. There's no law here, of God or man, that can do you or any one of us the least good. And this man, there's no earthly thing that he's too good to do. I could make anyone's hair rise and their teeth chatter if I should only tell what I've seen and been known to here, and it's no use resisting. Did I want to live with him? Wasn't I a woman, delicately bred? And he, God in heaven, what was he, and is he? And yet I've lived with him these 5 years and cursed every moment of my life night and day, and now he's got a new one, a young thing, only 15, and she's brought up, she says, piously. Her good mistress taught her to read the Bible, and she's brought her Bible here. To hell with her!" And the woman laughed a wild and doleful laugh that rung with a strange supernatural sound through the old ruined shed. Tom folded his hands. All was darkness and horror. "Oh, Jesus, Lord Jesus! Have you quite forgot us, poor critters? Burst forth, at last. Help, Lord, I perish!" The woman sternly continued. "And what are these miserable low dogs you work with, that you should suffer on their account? Every one of them would turn against you the first time they got a chance. They are all of them as low and cruel to each other as they can be. There's no use in your suffering to keep from hurting them." "Poor critters," said Tom. "What made them cruel? And if I give out, I shall get used to it and grow little by little just like them. No, no, missus, I've lost everything. Wife and children and home and a kind master. And he would have set me free if he'd only lived a week longer. I've lost everything in this world. And it's clean gone forever. And now I can't lose heaven, too. No. I can't get to be wicked besides all." "But it can't be that the Lord will lay sin to our account," said the woman. "He won't charge it to us when we're forced to it. He'll charge it to them that drove us to it." "Yes," said Tom. "But that won't keep us from growing wicked. If I get to be as hard-hearted as that our Sambo and as wicked, it won't make much odds to me how I came so. It's the being so. That's all what I'm a-dreadin'." The woman fixed a wild and startled look on Tom, as if a new thought had struck her, and then heavily groaning said, "Oh, God's mercy, you speak the truth. Oh, oh." And with groans she fell on the floor like one crushed and writhing under the extremity of mental anguish. There was a silence, a while, in which the breathing of both parties could be heard, when Tom faintly said, "Oh, please, missus." The woman suddenly rose up, with her face composed to its usual stern, melancholy expression. "Please, missus, I saw him throw my coat in that corner, and in my coat pocket is my Bible. If missus could please get it for me." Cassie went and got it. Tom opened at once to a heavily marked passage, much worn, of the last scenes in the life of him by whose stripes we are healed. "If missus would only be so good as to read that, it's better than water." Cassie took the book, with a dry, proud air, and looked over the passage. She then read aloud in a soft voice, and with a beauty of intonation that was peculiar, that touching account of anguish and of glory. Often as she read, her voice faltered, and sometimes failed her altogether, when she would stop, with an air of frigid composure, till she had mastered herself. When she came to the touching words, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," she threw down the book, and burying her face in the heavy masses of her hair, she sobbed aloud, with a convulsive violence. Tom was weeping also, and occasionally uttering a smothered ejaculation. "If we could only keep up to that hour," said Tom. "It seemed to come so natural to him, and we have to fight so hard for it. Oh, Lord, help us. Oh, blessed Lord Jesus, do help us."
Mrs. Sir Tom, after a while, I can see that somehow you're quite above me and everything, but there's one thing Mrs. might learn even from poor Tom. He said the Lord took sides against us, because he lets us be abused and knocked around. But you see what come on his own son, the blessed Lord of glory? Wasn't he Ali's pa? And have we any on us, yet come so low as he come? The Lord ain't forgot us, I'm certain. Oh, that are. If we suffer with him, we shall also reign, Scripture says. But if we deny him, he also will deny us. Didn't they all suffer, the Lord and all his? It tells how they were stoned and sawn asunder, and wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, and was destitute, afflicted, tormented. Suffering ain't no reason to make us think the Lord's turned agin us. Just the contrary, if only we hold on to him and doesn't give up to sin. But why does he put us where we can't help but sin? Said the woman. I think we can help it, said Tom. You'll see, said Cassie. What do you do? Tomorrow they'll be at you again. I know him. I've seen all their doings. I can't bear to think of all they'll bring to you. And they'll make you give out at last. Lord Jesus, said Tom, you take care of my soul. Oh, Lord, do. Don't let me give out. Oh, dear, said Cassie, I've heard all this crying and praying before, and yet they've been broken down and brought under. There's Emmeline, she's trying to hold on, and you're trying, but what's use? You must give up, or be killed by inches.
Well, then, I will die, said Tom. Spin it out as long as they can. They can't help my dying sometime. And after that, they can't do no more. I'm clear. I'm set. I know the Lord'll help me and bring me through.
The woman did not answer. She sat with her black eyes intently fixed on the floor.
Maybe it's the way, she murmured to herself. But those that have given up, there's no hope for them, none.
We live in filth and grow loathsome till we loathe ourselves, and we long to die, and we don't dare to kill ourselves.
No hope, no hope, no hope. This girl now, just as old as I was. You see me now, she said, speaking to Tom very rapidly. See what I am. Well, I was brought up in luxury. The first I remember is playing about when I was a child in splendid parlors, when I was kept dressed up like a doll in company, and visitors used to praise me. There was a garden opening from the saloon windows. And there I used to play hide-and-go-seek under the orange trees with my brothers and sisters. I went to a convent, and there I learned music, French, and embroidery, and what not. And when I was 14, I came out to my father's funeral. He died very suddenly. And when the property came to be settled, they found that there was scarcely enough to cover the debts. And when the creditors took an inventory of the property, I was set down in it. My mother was a slave woman, and my father had always meant to set me free, but he had not done it. And so I was set down in the list. I'd always known who I was, but never thought much about it. Nobody ever expects that a strong, healthy man is going to die. My father was a well man only 4 hours before he died. It was one of the first cholera cases in New Orleans. The day after the funeral, my father's wife took her children and went up to her father's plantation. I thought they treated me strangely, but didn't know. There was a young lawyer who they left to settle the business, and he came every day and was about the house and spoke very politely to me. He brought with him one day a young man, whom I thought the handsomest I had ever seen. I shall never forget that evening. I walked with him in the garden. I was lonesome and full of sorrow, and he was so kind and gentle to me, and he told me that he had seen me before I went to the convent, and that he had loved me a great while, and that he would be my friend and protector. In short, though, he didn't tell me. He had paid $2,000 for me, and I was his property. I became his willingly, for I loved him. Loved, said the woman, stopping. Oh, how I did love that man. How I love him now, and always shall, while I breathe. He was so beautiful, so high, so noble. He put me into a beautiful house with servants, horses, and carriages, and furniture, and dresses. Everything that money could buy, he gave me. But I didn't set any value on all that. I only cared for him. I loved him better than my God and my own soul. And if I tried, I couldn't do any other way from what he wanted me to. I wanted only one thing. I did want him to marry me. I thought if he loved me as he said he did, and if I was what he seemed to think I was, he would be willing to marry me and set me free. But he convinced me that it would be impossible, and he told me that.
If we were only faithful to each other, it was marriage before God. If that is true, wasn't I that man's wife? Wasn't I faithful?
For 7 years didn't I study every look and motion and only live and breathe to please him? He had the yellow fever, and for 20 days and nights I watched with him. I alone, and gave him all his medicine and did everything for him, and then he called me, his good angel, and said I'd saved his life. We had 2 beautiful children. The first was a boy, and we called him Henry. He was the image of his father. He had such beautiful eyes, such a forehead, and his hair hung all in curls around it. And he had all his father's spirit and his talent, too. Little Elise, he said, looked like me. He used to tell me that I was the most beautiful woman in Louisiana. He was so proud of me and the children. He used to love to have me dress them up, and take them and me about in an open carriage, and hear the remarks that people would make on us. And he used to fill my ears constantly with the fine things that were said in praise of me and the children. Oh, those were happy days. I thought I was as happy as anyone could be. But then there came evil times. He had a cousin come to New Orleans who was his particular friend. He thought all the world of him, but from the first time I saw him I couldn't tell why I dreaded him, for I felt sure he was going to bring misery on us. He got Henry to going out with him, and often he would not come home nights till 2 or 3 o'clock. I did not dare say a word, for Henry was so high-spirited. I was afraid to. He got him to the gaming houses, and he was one of the sort that when he once got a-going there, there was no holding back. And then he introduced him to another lady, and I saw soon that his heart was gone from me. He never told me, but I saw it. I knew it, day after day. I felt my heart breaking, but I could not say a word. At this the wretch offered to buy me and the children of Henry to clear off his gambling debts, which stood in the way of his marrying as he wished. And he sold us. He sold me, one day, that he had business in the country, and should be gone 2 or 3 weeks. He spoke kinder than usual, and said he should come back. But it didn't deceive me. I knew that the time had come. I was just like one turned into stone. I couldn't speak, nor shed a tear. He kissed me, and kissed the children a good many times, and went out. I saw him get on his horse, and I watched him till he was quite out of sight. And then I fell down and fainted. Then he came, the cursed wretch. He came to take possession. He told me that he had bought me and my children and showed me the papers. I cursed him before God and told him I'd die sooner than live with him. "Just as you please," said he. "But if you don't behave reasonably, I'll sell both the children, where you shall never see them again." He told me that he always had meant to have me, from the first time he saw me, and that he had drawn Henry on and got him in debt on purpose to make him willing to sell me. That he had got him in love with another woman, and that I might know after all that he should not give up for a few airs and tears and things of that sort. I gave up, for my hands were tied. He had my children. Whenever I resisted his will anywhere, he would talk about selling them, and he made me as submissive as he desired. Oh, what a life it was! To live with my heart breaking every day, to keep on, loving, when it was only misery, and to be bound body and soul to one I hated. I used to love to read to Henry, to play to him, to waltz with him and sing to him, but everything I did for this one was a perfect drag. Yet I was afraid to refuse anything. He was very imperious and harsh to the children. Elise was a timid little thing, but Henry was bold and high-spirited, like his father, and he had never been brought under, in the least, by anyone. He was always finding fault and quarreling with him, and I used to live in daily fear and dread. I tried to make the child respectful. I tried to keep them apart, for I held on to those children like death. But it did no good. He sold both those children. He took me to ride one day, and when I came home, they were nowhere to be found. He told me he had sold them. He showed me the money, the price of their blood. Then it seemed as if all good forsook me. I raved and cursed God and man, and for a while I believe he really was afraid of me. But he didn't give up so. He told me that my children were sold, but whether I ever saw their faces again depended on him, and that if I wasn't quiet, they should smart for it. Well, you can do anything with a woman when you've got her children. He made me submit. He made me be peaceable. He flattered me with hopes that perhaps he would buy them back. And so things went on, a week or two. One day I was out walking and passed by the calaboose. I saw a crowd about the gate, and I heard a child's voice. And suddenly my Henry broke away from 2 or 3 men who were holding him, and ran, screaming, and caught my dress. They came up to him, swearing dreadfully, and one man, whose face I shall never forget, told him that he wouldn't get away so, that he was going with him into the calaboose, and he'd get a lesson there he'd never forget. I tried to beg and plead. They only laughed.
the poor boy screamed. Looked into my face and held on to me until, in tearing him off, they tore the skirt of my dress half away, and they carried him in screaming, "Mother! Mother! Mother!" There was one man stood there seemed to pity me. I offered him all the money I had, if he'd only interfere.
He shook his head and said that the boy had been impudent and disobedient ever since he bought him, that he was going to break him in, once for all.
I turned and ran, and every step of the way I thought that I heard him scream. I got into the house, ran, all out of breath, to the parlor where I found Butler. I told him and begged him to go and interfere. He only laughed and told me the boy had got his deserts. He got to be broken in. The sooner the better. "What did I expect?" he asked. Seemed to me something in my head snapped at that moment. I felt dizzy and furious. I remember seeing a great sharp bowie knife on the table. I remember something about catching it and flying upon him, and then all grew dark, and I didn't know any more. Not for days and days. When I came to myself, I was in a nice room, but not mine. An old black woman tended me, and a doctor came to see me, and there was a great deal of care taken of me. After a while, I found that he had gone away and left me at this house to be sold, and that's why they took such pains with me. I didn't mean to get well and hoped I shouldn't, but in spite of me, the fever went off, and I grew healthy, and finally got up. Then they made me dress up every day, and gentlemen used to come in and stand and smoke their cigars and look at me and ask questions and debate my price. I was so gloomy and silent that none of them wanted me. They threatened to whip me if I wasn't gayer, and didn't take some pains to make myself agreeable. At length one day came a gentleman named Stuart. He seemed to have some feeling for me. He saw that something dreadful was on my heart, and he came to see me alone a great many times, and finally persuaded me to tell him. He bought me at last, and promised to do all he could to find and buy back the children. He went to the hotel where my Henry was. They told him he had been sold to a planter up on Pearl River. That was the last that I ever heard. Then he found where my daughter was. An old woman was keeping her. He offered an immense sum for her, but they would not sell her. Butler found out that it was for me he wanted her, and he sent me word that I should never have her. Captain Stuart was very kind to me. He had a splendid plantation and took me to it. In the course of a year, I had a son born. Oh, that child, how I loved it! How just like my poor Henry the little thing looked! But I had made up my mind, yes, I had, I would never again let a child live to grow up. I took the little fellow in my arms when he was 2 weeks old and kissed him and cried over him, and then I gave him laudanum. Held him close to my bosom while he slept to death. How I mourned and cried over it! Who ever dreamed that it was anything but a mistake that had made me give it the laudanum? But it's one of the few things that I'm glad of now. I'm not sorry to this day. He at last is out of pain. What better than death could I give him, poor child? After a while, the cholera came and Captain Stuart died. Everybody died that wanted to live. And I, though I went down to death's door, I lived. Then I was sold, passed from hand to hand. Till I grew faded and wrinkled, and I had a fever. And then this wretch bought me, and brought me here. And here I am. The woman stopped. She had hurried on through her story with a wild, passionate utterance, sometimes seeming to address it to Tom, and sometimes speaking as in a soliloquy. So vehement and overpowering was the force with which she spoke, that for a season Tom was beguiled, even from the pain of his wounds. And raising himself on one elbow, watched her as she paced restlessly up and down, her long black hair swaying heavily about her as she moved. "You tell me," she said after a pause, "that there is a God. A God that looks down and sees all these things. Maybe it's so. The sisters in the convent used to tell me of a day of judgment, when everything is coming to light. Won't there be vengeance then? They think it's nothing, what we suffer, nothing, what our children suffer. It's all a small matter. Yet I've walked the streets when it seemed as if I had misery enough in my one heart to sink the city. I've wished the houses would fall on me or the stones sink under me. Yes, and in the judgment day I will stand up before God, a witness against those that have ruined me and my children, body and soul. When I was a girl, I thought I was religious. I used to love God and prayer. Now I'm a lost soul, pursued by devils that torment me day and night.
They keep pushing me on and on, and I'll do it, too, some of these days," she said, clenching her hand, while an insane light glanced in her heavy black eyes. "I'll send him where he belongs. A short way, too, one of these nights. If they burn me alive for it." A wild, long laugh ran through the deserted room and ended in a hysteric sob. She threw herself on the floor in convulsive sobbing and struggles. In a few moments the frenzy fit seemed to pass off. She rose slowly and seemed to collect herself. "Can I do anything more for you, my poor fellow?" she said, approaching where Tom lay. "Shall I give you some more water?"
There was a graceful and compassionate sweetness in her voice and manner as she said this that formed a strange contrast with the former wildness. Tom drank the water and looked earnestly and pitifully into her face.
"Oh, missus, I wish you'd go to him that can give you living waters." "Go to him? Where is he? Who is he?" said Cassie. "Him that you read of to me, the Lord. I used to see the picture of him over the altar when I was a girl," said Cassie, her dark eyes fixing themselves in an expression of mournful reverie. "But he isn't here. There's nothing here but sin and long, long, long despair." She laid her hand on her breast and drew in her breath, as if to lift a heavy weight. Tom looked as if he would speak again, but she cut him short with a decided gesture. "Don't talk, my poor fellow. Try to sleep, if you can." And placing water in his reach, and making whatever little arrangements for his comfort she could, Cassie left the shed.
Chapter 35 The Tokens. And slight withal may be the things that bring back on the heart the weight which it would fling aside forever. It may be a sound, a flower, the wind, the ocean, which shall wound, striking the electric chain wherewith we're darkly bound. Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, Canon 4. The sitting room of Legree's establishment was a large, long room with a wide, ample fireplace. It had once been hung with a showy and expensive paper, which now hung mouldering, torn and discolored, from the damp walls. The place had that peculiar sickening, unwholesome smell, compounded of mingled damp dirt and decay, which one often notices in close old houses. The wallpaper was defaced in spots by slops of beer and wine, or garnished with chalk memorandums, and long sums footed up, as if somebody had been practicing arithmetic there. In the fireplace stood a brazier full of burning charcoal, for though the weather was not cold, the evenings always seemed damp and chilly in the great room, and Legree, moreover, wanted a place to light his cigars and heat his water for punch. The ruddy glare of the charcoal displayed the confused and unpromising aspect of the room. Saddlers, bridles, several sorts of harnesses, riding whips, overcoats, and various articles of clothing scattered up and down the room in confused variety. And the dogs, of whom we have before spoken, had encamped themselves among them to suit their own taste and convenience. Legree was just mixing himself a tumbler of punch, pouring his hot water from a cracked and broken-nosed pitcher, grumbling as he did so. "Plague on that Sambo to kick up this year row between me and the new hands. Fellow won't be fit to work for a week now, right in the press of the season." "Yes, just like you," said a voice behind his chair. It was the woman, Cassie, who had stolen upon his soliloquy. "Ah, you she-devil. You come back, have you?"
"Yes, I have," she said coolly. "Come to have my own way, too."
"You lie, you jade. I'll be up to my word. Either behave yourself or stay down to the quarters and fare and work with the rest."
"I'd rather, 10,000 times, said the woman, "live in the dirtiest hole at the quarters than be under your hoof." "But you are under my hoof, for all that," said he, turning upon her with a savage grin. "That's one comfort. So sit down here on my knee, my dear, and hear to reason," said he, laying hold on her wrist. "Simon Legree, take care," said the woman, with a sharp flash of her eye, a glance so wild and insane in its light as to be almost appalling. "You're afraid of me, Simon," she said deliberately, "and you've reason to be. But be careful, for I've got the devil in me." The last word she whispered in a hissing tone, close to his ear.
"Get out! I believe, to my soul you have," said Legree, pushing her from him, and looking uncomfortably at her. "After all, Cassie," he said, "why can't you be friends with me, as you used to?"
"Used to?" said she bitterly. She stopped short, A word of choking feelings rising in her heart kept her silent. Cassie had always kept over Legree the kind of influence that a strong, impassioned woman can ever keep over the most brutal man. But of late, she had grown more and more irritable and restless under the hideous yoke of her servitude, and her irritability, at times, broke out into raving insanity. And this liability made her a sort of object of dread to Legree, who had the superstitious horror of insane persons, which is common to coarse and uninstructed minds. When Legree brought Emmeline to the house, all the smoldering embers of womanly feeling flashed up in the worn heart of Cassie, and she took part with the girl, and a fierce quarrel ensued between her and Legree. Legree, in a fury, swore that she should be put to field service if she would not be peaceable. Cassie, with proud scorn, declared she would go to the field, and she worked there one day, as we have described, to show how perfectly she scorned the threat. Legree was secretly uneasy all day, for Cassie had an influence over him from which he could not free himself. When she presented her basket at the scales, he had hoped for some concession, and addressed her in a sort of half-conciliatory, half-scornful tone, and she had answered with the bitterest contempt. The outrageous treatment of poor Tom had aroused her still more, and she had followed Legree to the house, with no particular intention but to upbraid him for his brutality. "I wish, Cassie," said Legree, "you'd behave yourself decently."
"You talk about behaving decently? And what have you been doing? You, who haven't even sense enough to keep from spoiling one of your best hands right in the most pressing season just for your devilish temper."
"I was a fool, it's a fact, to let any such brangle come up," said Legree. "But when the boy set up his will, he had to be broke in."
"I reckon you won't break him in."
"Won't I?" said Legree, rising passionately. "I'd like to know. If I won't, he'll be the first nigger that ever came it round me. I'll break every bone in his body, but he shall give up."
Just then the door opened and Sambo entered. He came forward, bowing and holding out something in a paper.
"What's that, you dog?" said Legree.
"It's a witch thing, massa."
"A what?"
"Something that niggers gets from witches. Keeps 'em from feeling when they's flogged. He had it tied round his neck, with a black string."
Legree, like most godless and cruel men, was superstitious. He took the paper and opened it uneasily. There dropped out of it a silver dollar and a long shining curl of fair hair, hair which, like a living thing, twined itself around Legree's fingers.
"Damnation!" he screamed in sudden passion, stamping on the floor and pulling furiously at the hair, as if it burned him. "Where did this come from? Take it off! Burn it up! Burn it up!" he screamed, tearing it off and throwing it into the charcoal. "What did you bring it to me for?"
Sambo stood with his heavy mouth wide open and aghast with wonder, and Cassie, who was preparing to leave the apartment, stopped and looked at him in perfect amazement.
"Don't you bring me any more of your devilish things," said he, shaking his fist at Sambo, who retreated hastily towards the door,
and picking up the silver dollar, he sent it smashing through the window-pane out into the darkness. Sambo was glad to make his escape. When he was gone, Legree seemed a little ashamed of his fit of alarm. He sat doggedly down in his chair, and began sullenly sipping his tumbler of punch. Cassie prepared herself for going out, unobserved by him, and slipped away to minister to poor Tom, as we have already related.
And what was the matter with Legree? And what was there in a simple curl of fair hair to appall that brutal man, familiar with every form of cruelty?
To answer this, we must carry the reader backward in its history. Hard and reprobate as the godless man seemed now, there had been a time when he had been rocked on the bosom of a mother, cradled with prayers and pious hymns, his now-seared brow bedewed with the waters of holy baptism. In early childhood a fair-haired woman had led him at the sound of Sabbath bell to worship and to pray. Far in New England, that mother had trained her only son with long, unwearied love and patient prayers. Born of a hard-tempered sire, on whom that gentle woman had wasted a world of unvalued love, Legree had followed in the steps of his father, boisterous, unruly, and tyrannical. He despised all her counsel, and would none of her reproof, and at an early age broke from her to seek his fortunes at sea. He never came home but once after, and then his mother, with the yearning of a heart that must love something and has nothing else to love, clung to him and sought, with passionate prayers and entreaties, to win him from a life of sin to his soul's eternal good. That was Legree's day of grace. Then good angels called him, then he was almost persuaded, and mercy held him by the hand. His heart inly relented. There was a conflict, but sin got the victory, and he set all the force of his rough nature against the conviction of his conscience. He drank and swore, was wilder and more brutal than ever, and one night, when his mother, in the last agony of her despair, knelt at his feet, he spurned her from him, threw her senseless on the floor, and with brutal curses fled to his ship. The next Legree heard of his mother was, when one night,
As he was carousing among drunken companions, a letter was put into his hand. He opened it, and a lock of long, curling hair fell from it, entwined about his fingers. The letter told him his mother was dead, and that dying she blessed and forgave him. There is a dread, unhallowed necromancy of evil that turns things sweetest and holiest to phantoms of horror and affright. That pale, loving mother, her dying prayers, her forgiving love, wrought in that demoniac heart of sin only as a damning sentence, bringing with it a fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation. Legree burned the hair and burned the litter, and when he saw them hissing and crackling in the flame, inly shuddered as he thought of everlasting fires. He tried to drink and revel and swear away the memory, but often in the deep night, whose solemn stillness strains the bad soul in forced communion with herself, he had seen that pale mother rising by his bedside, and felt the soft twining of that hair around his fingers, till the cold sweat would roll down his face, and he would spring from his bed in horror. Ye who have wondered to hear, in the same evangel, that God is love, and that God is a consuming fire, see ye not how, to the soul resolved in evil, perfect love is the most fearful torture, the seal and sentence of the direst despair? Blast it, said Legree to himself as he sipped his liquor. Where did he get that? If it didn't look just like... I thought I'd forgot that. Curse me, if I think there's any such thing as forgetting anything. Anyhow, hang it. I'm lonesome. I mean to call M. She hates me, the monkey. I don't care. I'll make her come.
Legree stepped out into a large entry, which went upstairs, by what had formerly been a superb winding staircase, but the passageway was dirty and dreary, encumbered with boxes and unsightly litter. The stairs, uncarpeted, seemed winding up. In the gloom, to nobody knew where. The pale moonlight streamed through a shattered fanlight over the door. The air was unwholesome and chilly, like that of a vault.
Legree stopped at the foot of the stairs and heard a voice singing. It seemed strange and ghost-like in that dreary old house, perhaps because of the already tremulous state of his nerves.
Hark! What is it? A wild, pathetic voice chants a hymn common among the slaves. Oh, there'll be morning, morning, morning. Oh, there'll be mourning at the judgment seat of Christ.
Blast that girl, said Legree. I'll choke her.
M?
M, he called harshly, but only a mocking echo from the walls answered him. The sweet voice still sung on.
Parents and children there shall part, parents and children there shall part to meet no more.
And clear and loud swelled through the empty halls the refrain.
There'll be mourning, mourning, mourning. Oh, there'll be mourning at the judgment seat of Christ.
Legree stopped. He would have been ashamed to tell of it, but large drops of sweat stood on his forehead. His heart beat heavy and thick with fear. He even thought he saw something white rising and glimmering in the gloom before him, and shuddered to think, what if the form of his dead mother should suddenly appear to him? I know one thing, he said to himself, as he stumbled back in the sitting room and sat down. I'll let that fellow alone after this. What did I want of his cussed paper? I believe I am bewitched, sure enough. I've been shivering and sweating ever since. Where did he get that hair? It couldn't have been that. I burnt that up. I know I did. It would be a joke if hair could rise from the dead.
Ah, Legree, that golden tress was charmed.
Each hair had in it a spell of terror and remorse for thee, and was used by a mightier power to bind thy cruel hands from inflicting uttermost evil on the helpless.
I say, said Legree, stamping and whistling to the dogs, wake up, some of you, and keep me company.
But the dogs only opened one eye at him, sleepily, and closed it again.
I'll have Sambo and Quimbo up here, to sing and dance one of their hell dances, and keep off these horrid notions, said Legree.
And putting on his hat, he went on to the veranda, and blew a horn, with which he commonly summoned his two sable drivers.
Legree was often wont, when in a gracious humour, to get these two worthies into his sitting-room, and after warming them up with whiskey, amuse himself by setting them to singing, dancing, or fighting, as the humour took him. It was between 1 and 2 o'clock at night, as Cassie was returning from her ministrations to poor Tom, that she heard the sound of wild shrieking, whooping, hallowing, and singing from the sitting-room, mingled with the barking of dogs and other symptoms of general uproar. She came up on the veranda steps and looked in. Legree and both the drivers, in a state of furious intoxication, were singing, whooping, upsetting chairs, and making all manner of ludicrous and horrid grimaces at each other. She rested her small, slender hand on the window blind, and looked fixedly at them. There was a world of anguish, scorn, and fierce bitterness in her black eyes.
as she did so. Would it be a sin to rid the world of such a wretch? She said to herself. She turned hurriedly away, and passing around to a back door, glided upstairs and tapped at Emmeline's door. Chapter 36 Emmeline and Cassie. Cassie entered the room and found Emmeline sitting, pale with fear, in the furthest corner of it. As she came in, the girl started up nervously, but on seeing who it was, rushed forward and, catching her arm, said, "Oh, Cassie, is it you? I'm so glad you've come. I was afraid it was... Oh, you don't know what a horrid noise there has been downstairs all this evening."
"I ought to know," said Cassie dryly. "I've heard it often enough."
"Oh, Cassie, do tell me. Couldn't we get away from this place?"
"I don't care where. Into the swamp, among the snakes, anywhere. Couldn't we get somewhere away from here?"
"Nowhere but into our graves," said Cassie.
"Did you ever try?"
"I've seen enough of trying and what comes of it," said Cassie.
"I'd be willing to live in the swamps and gnaw the bark from trees. I ain't afraid of snakes. I'd rather have one near me than him," said Emmeline eagerly.
"There have been a good many here of your opinion," said Cassie, "but you couldn't stay in the swamps. You'd be tracked by the dogs, and brought back, and then.
"What would he do?" said the girl, looking with breathless interest into her face.
"What wouldn't he do, you'd better ask," said Cassie. "He's learned his trade well among the pirates in the West Indies. You wouldn't sleep much if I should tell you things I've seen, things that he tells of sometimes for good jokes. I've heard screams here that I haven't been able to get out of my head for weeks and weeks. There's a place way out down by the quarters where you can see a black, blasted tree, and the ground all covered with black ashes. Ask anyone what was done there, and see if they will dare to tell you."
"Ah, what do you mean?"
"I won't tell you. I hate to think of it, and I tell you, the Lord only knows what we may see tomorrow. If that poor fellow holds out as he's begun."
"Horrid," said Emmeline, every drop of blood receding from her cheeks. "Cassie, do tell me what I shall do."
"What I've done. Do the best you can, do what you must, and make it up in hating and cursing."
"He wanted to make me drink some of his hateful brandy," said Emmeline, "and I hate it so."
"You'd better drink," said Cassie. "I hated it too, and now I can't live without it. One must have something. Things don't look so dreadful when you take that."
"Mother used to tell me never to touch any such thing," said Emmeline.
"Mother told you," said Cassie, with a thrilling and bitter emphasis on the word mother. "What use is it for mothers to say anything?
You are all to be bought and paid for, and your souls belong to whoever gets you. That's the way it goes. I say drink brandy, drink all you can, and it'll make things come easier."
"Oh, Cassie, do pity me."
"Pity you? Don't I? Haven't I a daughter? Lord knows where she is. And whose she is
now, going the way her mother went before her. I suppose that her children must go after her. There's no end to the curse forever." "I wish I'd never been born," said Emmeline, wringing her hands.
"That's an old wish with me," said Cassie. "I've got used to wishing that. I'd die if I dared to," she said, looking out into the darkness with that still fixed despair, which was the habitual expression of her face when at rest.
"It would be wicked to kill oneself," said Emmeline. "I don't know why. No wickeder than things we live and do, day after day. But the sisters told me things, when I was in the convent, that make me afraid to die. If it would only be the end of us, why then—"
Emmeline turned away and hid her face in her hands.
While this conversation was passing in the chamber, Legree, overcome with his carouse, had sunk to sleep in the room below.
Legree was not an habitual drunkard. His coarse, strong nature craved and could endure a continual stimulation that would have utterly wrecked and crazed a finer one. But a deep underlying spirit of cautiousness prevented his often yielding to appetite in such measure as to lose control of himself. This night, however, in his feverish efforts to banish from his mind those fearful elements of woe and remorse which woke within him, he had indulged more than common, so that when he had discharged his sable attendants, he fell heavily on a settle in the room and was sound asleep. Oh, how dares the bad soul to enter the shadowy world of sleep? That land whose dim outlines lie so fearfully near to the mystic sense of retribution.
Legree dreamed. In his heavy and feverish sleep, a veiled form stood beside him, and laid a cold, soft hand upon him. He thought he knew who it was, and shuddered, with creeping horror, though the face was veiled. Then he thought he felt that hair twining round his fingers, and then that it slid smoothly round his neck, and tightened, and tightened, and he could not draw his breath, and then he thought voices whispered to him, whispers that chilled him with horror. Then it seemed to him he was on the edge of a frightful abyss, holding on, and struggling in mortal fear, while dark hands stretched up and were pulling him over, and Cassie came behind him laughing, and pushed him, and then rose up that solemn veiled figure, and drew aside the veil. It was his mother. She turned away from him, and he fell down, 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 amid a confused noise of shrieks and groans and shouts of demon laughter. And Legree awoke. Calmly the rosy hue of dawn was stealing into the room. The morning star stood with its solemn, holy eye of light, looking down on the man of sin from out of the brightening sky. Oh, with what freshness, what solemnity and beauty is each new day born, as if to say to insensate man, behold, thou hast one more chance. Strive for immortal glory. There is no speech nor language where this voice is not heard, but the bold, bad man heard it not. He woke with an oath and a curse. What to him was the golden purple, the daily miracle of morning? What to him the sanctity of the star, which the Son of God had hallowed as his own emblem? Brute-like, he saw without perceiving, and stumbling forward poured out a tumbler of brandy, and drank half of it.
"I've had a hell of a night," he said to Cassie, who just then entered from an opposite door. "You'll get plenty of the same sort by and by," said she dryly.
"What do you mean, you minx?"
"You'll find out one of these days," returned Cassie, in the same tone. "Now, Simon, I've one piece of advice to give you."
"The devil you have!"
"My advice is," said Cassie steadily, as she began adjusting some things about the room,
"that you let Tom alone."
"What business is it to yours?" "What? To be sure. I don't know what it should be. If you want to pay 1,200 for a fellow and use him right up in the press of the season, just to serve your own spite, it's no business of mine. I've done what I can do for him. You have.
What business have you meddling in my matters?"
"None, to be sure. I've saved you some thousands of dollars at different times by taking care of your hands. That's all the thanks I get. If your crop comes shorter into the market than any of theirs, you won't lose your bet, I suppose. Tompkins won't lord it over you, I suppose, and you'll pay down your money like a lady, won't you? I think I see you doing it." Legree, like many other planters, had but one form of ambition, to have in the heaviest crop of the season, and he had several bets on this very present season pending in the next town. Cassie, therefore, with women's tact, touched the only string that could be made to vibrate.
"Well, I'll let him off at what he's got," said Legree, "but he shall beg my pardon, and promise better fashions."
"That he won't do," said Cassie.
"Won't they?"
"No, he won't," said Cassie. "I'd like to know why, mistress," said Legree, in the extreme of scorn. "Because he's done right, and he knows it, and won't say he's done wrong."
"Who a cuss cares what he knows? The nigger shall say what I please, or—"
"Or you'll lose your bet on the cotton crop by keeping him out of the field, just at this very press."
"But he will give up, of course, he will. Don't I know what niggers is? He'll beg like a dog this morning."
"He won't, Simon. You don't know this kind. You may kill him by inches. You won't get the first word of confession out of him."
"We'll see. Where is he?" said Legree, going out.
"In the waste room of the gin house," said Cassie.
Legree, though he talked so stoutly to Cassie, still sallied forth from the house with a degree of misgiving, which was not common with him. His dreams of the past night mingled with Cassie's prudential suggestions considerably affected his mind. He resolved that nobody should be witness of his encounter with Tom, and determined, if he could not subdue him by bullying, to defer his vengeance, to be wreaked in a more convenient season. The solemn light of dawn, the angelic glory of the morning star, had looked in through the rude window of the shed where Tom was lying. And as if descending on that starbeam came the solemn words, "I am the root and offspring of David and the bright and morning star." The mysterious warnings and intimations of Cassie, so far from discouraging his soul, in the end had roused it, as with a heavenly call. He did not know but that the day of his death was dawning in the sky, and his heart throbbed with solemn throes of joy and desire, as he thought that the wondrous,
all of which he had often pondered, the great white throne, with its ever-radiant rainbow, the white-robed multitude, with voices as many waters, the crowns, the palms, the harps might all break upon his vision before that sun should set again.